When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Think you know the Brooks Ghost? Think again. Introducing the all-new, better-than-ever Ghost 16. Now with nitrogen-infused cushioning for lightweight, supreme softness that feels good every step, every street, every single day. So go ahead, take your daily joyride in the all-new nitrogen-infused Ghost 16. It'll turn your everyday miles into everyday endorphins. Let's run there. Head to brooksrunning.com to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. You're listening to New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbun, and I'm coming to you from Sydney, Australia, where I'm a senior lecturer at Macquarie University. And I'm here today speaking with Corey Cropper, who's a professor of French at Brigham Young University. And he's one of the two authors of a fantastic new book, and one that had me laughing a lot, actually, in a really good way. Called Velocipedomania, A Cultural History of the Velocipede in France. It's out with Bucknell University Press this year, so it's hot off the presses. And again, the two authors are Corey Cropper, professor of French at Brigham Young University, who we're speaking with today, and also Seth Whitten, professor of French literature and fellow at Queen's College, Oxford. Thank you so much for joining me today, Corey.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And I mentioned before we started interviewing that I love this book. It's not, I'm a French historian by training, but I do the new books in sports. It's not often I get to read new books in French history, in French studies, as well as reading something in sports history. And this book was just a real pleasure for me. So thank you for writing it. And I was wondering, we were talking a little bit before, and I said, oh, well, I always ask first, how did you develop this project? And Corey said, maybe ask me first how I became a cyclist. So Corey, why don't you start us off? How did you get into cycling?
Well, thanks for having me on, first of all, Keith. And this has been a really fun project for both Seth and for me. I think because we both do bike and it's a passion outside of the academy for us. And my story, I grew up in Western Idaho, and in the late 70s, there was the oil crisis, and it meant that gas was rationed, and it meant that we all had bikes, and if I wanted to go to get to school, to get to church, to go fishing, it was Idaho, I had to ride. And so this is where I took up biking as a purely kind of utilitarian thing. But the story I do want to tell is I got into racing with other 9 and 10 year olds in my hometown. We would race around our elementary school. It was on a block, and I was set out on a race one afternoon after school, and I think I would have won this one, Keith. I was way ahead. hit some gravel in a corner and went down, and broke my front teeth out. And I remember going back later, I went home and my father wanted to take me to the dentist, but he wanted to go look to see if he could find the teeth. And it was all this white gravel. So there was no way. So I still have crowns on my front teeth from a bike crash I had when I started to bike back during the oil crisis in the late 70s. So that's my story. I biked again. I saw the Tour de France for the first time in Toulouse as a 16-year-old exchange student. And I biked in France when I was an LDS missionary in the late 80s, early 90s, rode all around, crashed, did the whole thing. And then I kind of got away from it until here in Provo, Utah, where Brigham Young University is located. A colleague of mine introduced me to it, reintroduced me to it, and it just really took. And so I bike as much as I can. I tell new faculty here at BYU, I do training for them occasionally, and I always say, if you aren't biking, you need to start so you can get out of town, get into the mountains, and just refresh your soul and your mind, and come back and be a better teacher and scholar because of it. So that's my bicycle history.
It's not to go too far afield from the book right away, but I hear some of the same tensions in the book in your description of biking. It's both pleasure and at the same time kind of practical and utilitarian, and I do sports history. I talk to a lot of fellow scholars who are into sport, and so many of them are bikers. And I do wonder if there's something kind of linking the neoliberal academia and cycling.
Right. It's certainly possible, but as a professor, at least, that my schedule is flexible enough that I can go biking when the weather's good. And then if I have to work later in the night or get up earlier, I'm able to do that. So maybe the flexibility of our schedule lends to biking as much as anything else.
And I do want to get to how you hooked up with Seth and how you guys started the project, but I presume you're not the book's Velocipedomania, but it's not actually about the bicycles that we might all be familiar with. And I presume you're not riding a velocipede around Provo.
No, I wish. I tried to convince my dean that he needed to buy, and the museum at the university, that they needed to buy a velocipede just so that we could show it off in our museum. But I wasn't successful in that. So no, I ride a regular bicycle.
For those listeners who don't know, maybe you could tell us a little bit about what a velocipede is and how it's different from the bike that I think many of us know and love.
Yeah. So the velocipede was popular in the late 1860s and was developed in France. And there are a lot of different histories about the velocipede. A lot of people say that the origin, if you read a history of the bicycle, you'll see usually part of a chapter will talk about the drazine, which was this, or in French they call it a drazienne. It was basically a fence post with wheels on either side, and people would sit on this and run along and push off with their feet. And this started around the time of the, right after the eruption of Mount Tambora in Indonesia. And the myth, or the legend at least, goes that there was this eruption caused crop shortages in Europe, a mini ice age, and that led people to even not be able to feed or have to eat their horses. And so the Baron von Dreis created this way of getting around that replaced the horse for a time. But then in the 1860s in France, a blacksmith came up with the idea of taking that general design, two wheels with a frame, and adding pedals to the front. So a velocipede is iron-framed, wooden-wheeled, almost like wagon wheels, with this pedal engineered right under the front wheel, so there's no gearing at all. There was a brake added to the back wheel, activated by a lever on the handlebars, but that's it. So the English started calling this the bone shaker, and this is not to be confused either with the high wheeler, or the gombi, as they call it in French, that came a little later. This is the one with the high wheeler, or the gombi, is that kind of comically large front wheel that was used for racing and was faster in the absence of gears than the velocipede. But the velocipede's front and rear wheels were not identical in size, but similar in size. But it was pretty heavy, top speeds of 15 kilometers, 16 kilometers an hour or so, and a rough ride.
Yeah. When I was reading so many of the excerpts, I was kind of thinking that myself, like, oh, this would have been not as much fun to ride as they're describing. But
for sure. So I wish I had ridden one, though. So we had arranged to meet with people at the Smithsonian to look at some. We had a conference out there, and then COVID hit and everything shut down. Huh. So we never got that chance.
That's a total bummer. That would have been awesome, actually. I did wonder how much, I mean, because you're a cyclist, and sounds like maybe Seth's also a cyclist. And so much, I'm jumping ahead of myself in some ways, but so much of the book it includes these big translations of great primary source documents. And that, you know, at one point in time, you're kind of reading how to ride a velocipede, and I'm like, I just need to take this and I can show now my daughter, I'll just read this to her. And the rules are not that dissimilar, you know?
Yeah, that's right. There are a couple of places in the book where there are instructions just on how to ride the velocipede, how to get started. And I don't know that they're actually great instructions, but So Seth, I will say too, parenthetically, Seth and I have biked together before. We both have had an interest in cycling, and I've published on sports before. And we talked about doing a project together. He's a big baseball fan, but we're both 19th century French specialists, and not much baseball was played in 19th century France. And I'd done some work on cycling, and then at a certain point, Seth had the idea to translate together the manual, Le Manuel du Vélocipède by Le Grand Jacques, the Manual of the Velocipede. So we started working on that and just realized how much material was out there and expanded it into Velocipedomania, the book that we ended up publishing.
Yeah, so can you, for people who haven't read it, can you kind of walk us through a bit, like, how do you classify this book in terms of genre? Like, what were your goals? I could do it, but I think it's better if you do it.
Yeah, sure. We started just thinking, hey, this manual of the Velocipede is really important. Maybe one of the first texts that's kind of a comprehensive text written about that's a standalone text about bicycling, or the precursor to the bicycle anyway, the Velocipede. So we started working on that, and then we realized we needed some more. So The after an introduction, the first thing we translated is actually a treatise on practical applications of the Velocipede, and someone who's arguing for the utility of the Velocipede. And then we saw there were a number of theatrical productions that included Velocipedes, including the operetta that you mentioned called Dagobert and His Velocipede. We translated that as well. Then there's the Manual of the Velocipede. That's really the heart of the book, and an analysis of that. And then we included a few poems that about the Velocipede, one that was written in Latin by a French high school student. We translated that. So we wanted to make all this available to an English reading audience and then make it coherent through our introductions by explaining how the Velocipede fit and reflected late 1860 French culture, and how it also created ideas and a kind of culture that extends to the modern bicycle. And the way we perceive the bicycle, the way the French perceive bicycling today, has roots back in this formative period in the late 1860s.
Yeah, I finished the book completely convinced and charmed. And I like I had mentioned before we started recording, that Dagobert and His Velocipede, when I read that, I was just laughing out loud because it's just really funny. And I immediately wanted to see it staged. I was like, this is like a perfect little operetta that would be fun to see.
Yeah. And we have a big French club here at my university of students, and I'm trying to convince them that they've got to put this on.
I think they should. Well, and you should tie that together with the purchase of a Velocipede too.
Exactly.
Well, then I guess let's, you had mentioned, I guess before we started recording again, we could talk a little bit more about kind of how you imagine using these sources and how they're useful for you in classrooms. Like, I think I'd like to talk more about that, but we could also jump into those chapters themselves. What do you want to record?
Yeah, maybe I could start this. There's a quote that we used as to lead off the book, an epigraph that I think is really telling. It's from a journalist writing in 1869 in a journal called Le Monde Illustré, or a newspaper called Le Monde Illustré. And he writes this: "The time has come to speak of the velocipede. The velocipede is in our culture. It has entered our blood. It has become an institution. The velocipede had to be born. It is now synonymous with our time and with our culture." And we took that as a starting point, in a way, to start looking at the velocipede and how it reflects the culture, how it was synonymous with the culture of France in the late 1860s. And we found threads of this in all of the different kinds of texts that we wanted to make available. There's a huge, not just academics, but cycling fans in general, people who like cycling history, and we wanted to make these texts available to them and then also contextualize it and show how it reflected French culture, how it had entered our blood, Iriarte says. So that's kind of where we started.
I was definitely struck in some ways, and I mentioned it earlier, throughout in your documents, between this tension between practicality and almost, between practicality and pleasure, or practicality and transcendence. And in some ways that strikes me as some of the tension inherent in that late Second Empire as well. So I wonder if you can talk us through a little bit of that.
Yeah. So the first text that we translate is we call it the note on Monsieur Michaud's velocipede. One of the contributions that we hope the book, that it's a small footnote maybe in the broader history of bicycling, but is that we were able to triangulate who the author of this note was. It was published anonymously in 1868. But we found a number of articles in the press, and taken together with that, maybe other researchers hadn't seen, and taken together with what the author writes in the note on the velocipede, we're able to identify him as a certain baron named Baron de la Rue, who worked at the Ministry of the Navy in the 1860s. And so it's what seems to have happened is that he liked to ride the velocipede so much. He was criticized for showing up at work in a sweat. And it's almost like he tried to justify his bicycle or his velocipede riding by writing a treatise showing how useful the velocipede could be to the French state. And so he does talk about the pleasure of being out in nature on this. But I thought maybe I'd read just a little passage that was written in about him in Le Figaro, which is this big French daily newspaper. This is a description of the Baron de la Rue, who wrote this note. So the journalist, whose name is Coulange, writes, "The Baron de la Rue is the inventor of the nautical velocipede. The day he invented it was the best day of his life." And it goes on to describe this article he wrote. "Each morning, de la Rue could be seen arriving at the ministry on his two-wheeled horse, sweating and panting as if the fate of France were in the balance. Each evening, he went straight to the writing school of the famous Michaud, the Gambetta of the velocipede. In the office, he spoke only about velocipedes, thought only about velocipedes, breathed only velocipedes. When he would blow his nose, he did it velocipedically. It appears he hadn't changed, and that he spends his time," he's been transferred at this point to a port out in Brittany. "He spends his time navigating the port on his famous nautical velocipede. in his neighborhood, they all call him the subprefect of velocipedes. So I think all of those of us who are cyclists can relate to this idea of merging our passion of cycling with our work. And he may be the first person to do that in writing, and I'm certainly his descendant in that respect.
I definitely appreciated this particular document because it kind of lay, and you see it again in the manual of the Velocipede, but it comes out very clearly here in this first document, the kind of way in which someone's personal passion, they find ways of kind of making it modern and useful. And maybe it's modern already, but for him, it was clearly about passion.
Yeah. Well, there you mentioned the paradox, but this is one of those paradoxes, right? You've got this, it's modern, it's this new technology that people are trying to get accepted. And then at the same time, there's this just sort of almost aesthetic pleasure of riding, of feeling the wind in your, you know, in your face, and of getting out of town, which Delarue, this, the author of this note, talks about too. But he does spend most of his time saying, here's how this could be useful for making France, Second Empire France, move forward and be better. He talks about, for example, rescue operations. People will be able to get to where they need to go more quickly. More territory can be patrolled and protected from poachers by rangers. Commuting will be faster. Information, telegraphs will be delivered more quickly. Mail can be delivered more efficiently. And that is kind of the essence of what he's trying to accomplish here, is argued for the utility based on what he, and I'm quoting him, his extensive experience writing.
Yeah, it was kind of taken by both that in this in the note and also in the manual of the Velocipede, how much the discussion of its efficiency is very scientific and technical. At one point in time, I'm like, man, I feel like I should have paid more attention in my physics classes, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Kind of walking you through the effort it takes to move the Velocipede this much, but at the grade of this, well, you can still walk on it and lean on it. And
yeah, and that's Le Grand Jacques in the manual of the Velocipede goes into these really detailed calculations of how much energy you save by riding a Velocipede versus walking. And I would say it's pseudoscientific, right? They're trying to make the argument in favor of the Velocipede, obviously, and why it should be adopted. So, yeah, but it's funny. And one thing that Delarue points out, and this is a problem with no gear, he says, if you get above 4%, you just got to walk it. But he adds, you're at least leaning against it, so you save energy there too.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. That doesn't sound like a great argument to me, but
I don't know. I walked around a lot in the last 6 years with a stroller, and
You can only
lean on a stroller.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Can lean on it. Yeah,
but that might just be my experience.
So one of the things that we, we have this translation of this note that argues for the utility, but I have a colleague, Marc Olivier. He's in my department, the French department here at Brigham Young University. And he has written quite a bit on new technology and introducing new technology. And his argument is that the usefulness only takes you so far. The argument for utility is limited. That if you really want to get new technology established, you have to connect it to already established cultural forms, something that's already familiar to potential users. He says that machines need to be socialized. And a great example of this is, you might remember these, when the personal computer originally came out, the idea they had to promote it was to use Charlie Chaplin. I mean, an actor looking like Charlie Chaplin, obviously, but to say, hey, this is something even this actor who was in modern times, who was bewildered by new technology, he can figure it out. And there's a connection to something that the public is relatable to. And so we see that that's a kind of, we shift in the book from this discussion of the utility to, and even, you know, the introduction to the manual on the philosophy talks about mixing the useful and the beautiful, l'utile et le beau. And that's how we ended up. That's one of the reasons we wanted to include this, the operetta that you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, I love the whole chapter, and then obviously the operetta after, about velocipedes on stage. And I was really kind of, thinking about, you know, the way in which stage productions sometimes take on these fantastical and almost untried or untested elements, and how they really become part of the show. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about when do we first start seeing or reading about, in the circumstance, velocipede on stage, and how are they being used in these stage productions in Paris?
To back up just a little bit, an important development happens in 1864, and that's when Napoleon III's government decides to deregulate theaters. There was a limit on the kinds of and the number of plays, and it was controlled by the state in an effort to promote certain types of productions. After 1864, it's completely freed up, liberalized, and so you see new genres developing. And so there are like these acrobatic performances, and that's where the velocipede is originally used on stage. Michaud's son, who's this, I should mention parenthetically that there's debate over whether or not Michaud should be given credit for inventing the velocipede. He was a metal worker and a smith. But what's clear is that in the minds of the public, he was like, he's the mythological creator of it. You know, whether he did it or it was the Olivier brothers or there are other names that were suggested, the public associates the velocipede with him. But close parentheses there, but his son was a promoter, and they would do these exhibitions along the quay of the Seine River. They did a number of acrobatic acts in plays, in reviews on stage in Paris in 1868, 1869. And then you start to see the velocipede take on a life of its own outside of that merely acrobatic performance, but become part of the action in the plays, part of the narrative.
So maybe we can talk then about the play that you all translated, and how you did the translation, and tell us a little bit about Dagobert.
Yeah, so Dagobert and his philosophy. Dagobert is a French king from the 7th century. The advantage of Dagobert versus, say, Louis XIV or François Premier, some of these other kings, is that he was relatively unknown, and there wasn't a great deal of political resonance. So the French could kind of write onto this king what they wanted. So it's the operetta is set in the 17th, and what he's known for actually is from a revolutionary era song that kind of made fun of the nobility, and he's known for putting his knickers on backwards. That's the lyrics to a song. And that song appears in this operetta, and operetta means that it's partly sung, partly in regular dialogue. And that song, the song about Dagobert is a theme that runs through the music. And I'll mention here too, that if you're interested in listening to the music, velocipede.byu.edu, and we've recorded, I had a student play this on the piano and record it, all the music from the operetta. I didn't sing anything to it. I'm sure you'll be disappointed to hear that, Keith, but I did, but all the music is there, in addition to other songs that were inspired by the velocipede and published in the same period, 1867, 68, 69. So if anybody wants to listen to that, but the song "Ne Bon Wat Dagobe" is a theme throughout. And so the one of my favorite parts of doing this project was actually translating the songs. And I hope that the rhyme and the some of the spirit of that came through, because I tried to preserve the rhyme and the meter as much as possible as well when I worked on this part. And then, of course, Seth Witten, my colleague in Oxford, who worked on this with me, he corrected it. But I taught a class on the operetta, 19th century French operetta, a couple years ago, before, as we were working on this, and I brought it to, so I had my students read it, and I gave them passages and invited them to try to translate it. And this operetta is full of puns. Some of them are just terrible puns, real groaners. But one of them, if maybe I can describe it just to give you a sense for the kind of challenges we had translating this. There's a question about the paternity of one of the main characters. And at the end of the play, it's revealed, I don't want to spoil it, but it is revealed who this character's father was. On one of the wheels of the velocipede that appears throughout the operetta, it's written, "Mon fils a des cheveux," my son has hair. And because it's written on the wheel, the word for wheel in French is roux, and the word for red hair, red, is roux. So mon fils a des cheveux roux, it's this pun between the word wheel and hair. So translate that, right? I initially had something about my son is up a creek without a pedal, but that didn't really work. It's terrible. I know it's terrible, but I took it to my class, and one of my students had this brilliant idea. Let me read. I'm going to read the passage, if that's okay, just part of this. So this is from the last scene of the operetta. Dagobert stops this character named Goldbrick and says, "Wait, we have to be sure you're not playing me for a fool. Are you really my brother's son?" He says, "Go get my velocipede. If you're really my brother's son, you'll be able to tell me what's engraved on the left pedal." Goldbrick, "Of course, the engraving reads, 'My son has wheely red hair.'" But I'm thump. "And what does that mean?" "It means my son has really wet red hair. See for yourself." And Goldbrick takes off his hat and shows his hair off. "Wheely," and then the minister says, "In legal terms, we call that a pun." And then Dagobert and his nephew embrace, now that he knows he's his nephew. So that was, my student came up with that idea of wheely red hair. I thought it was better than my weak attempt, so we went with that.
I'm going to have to give your student credit.
Yeah, he did a good job. I even included him in a note. So if you...
I mean, if you're reading this, by the way, I'm not joking, listeners, when I said this is one of the most fun things I've read this year. The layer of punning and joking is very thick. It is almost, I was so surprised in reading it, because it's almost postmodern in its take. At some point in time, you can't believe that this was written when it was written, you know, like this was written in the 1860s. I mean, there's in legal terms, that's called a pun. That's a running, they have that running gag. Oh, in legal terms, let's call it. And then, of course, Dagobert consulting the encyclopedia to find out what he does.
Yes. Yeah. The operettas in 19th century French, they were, a lot of the jokes are built around anachronism. Certainly in this operetta, that's the case. And around sort of these parodies of more serious operas and opéra comique that people would have known in the same way we know, you know, Netflix series and films today. And so there's a lot of sort of meta humor going on in them. It's a lot of fun.
I was flipping back and forth to the notes, you know, just kind of continually while I'm reading this, and I'm laughing reading what just so that I can get. And then I look at the note and I start laughing again. I'm like, it's a very clever writing. And honestly, the translation was amazing. You did keep the meter, you did keep the rhyme. I was impressed. I was, when I'm reading it, I was like, oh man, this would have been quite a difficult task.
Yeah, it was a labor of love, but we had a lot of fun doing it too. I mean, it's a fun topic. And so we, you know, got into it and just played around a lot with it to make it work.
And you do have to get your students to do it now. I mean, you know, it's...
Yeah, that's right.
Must be staged.
Yeah, I know. I do. We need to do that. I'll work on that, Keith. So...
Your following chapter, though, and we should get to it, because as you mentioned before, this is kind of the meat of your book, is this manual of the Velocipede. And so I guess, you know, we could approach it by first talking about the author. We could talk through that you and Seth identify a series of themes. So I don't know if you want to introduce.
Yeah, so the author is, he goes by Le Grand Jacques, the big or the great Jacques. Or James, and he goes by a lot of different pseudonyms, though, too. But the author is Richard Lesclide, who was the personal secretary to Victor Hugo. He wrote other novels and short stories, wrote for newspapers quite a bit, and he sometimes used the pseudonym Le Grand Jacques. He wrote plays as well. But he was a promoter of the Velocipede from start to the end of his life. And he started a newspaper as well about the Velocipede called the Vélocipède Illustré. It changed names several times, but that kept going off and on in spurts until he died. And I should mention too that he teamed up with an illustrator named Émile Benassi, who was well known for illustrations and all kinds of publications and newspapers at the time. And he, you know, he had to come up with a way to depict the Velocipede, to communicate movement. And so we talk to some extent about the engravings that are in the manual, and we reproduce them all in the book. So we hope that's also a useful resource and something that's just fun for people who read the book.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Super fun. And also, I was surprised. I mean, it's very rare that you can point to these examples of, I mean, Benassi's like a, you know, relatively, you know, almost minor character in some ways, but he creates this whole visual lexicon, which if you read or look at comics today, is still the visual lexicon.
Yeah, that's right.
Of and of other things.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, how do you draw movement, and how do you pick? And I think maybe his biggest contribution is the way he depicts women's fashion, and particularly, you know, there he shows men riding as well, but the fashion of the female velocipedist is to me one of the most interesting aspects of this whole thing, because you know that there was a sort of police decree that in Paris women were not allowed to wear pants. That was went into effect in 1800, and actually wasn't revoked until like 2013 or 2016. I've got it written down here. I want to get the right date. 2013 is when that was finally taken off the books. Of course, it was not enforced terribly well. But you know, you hear these stories of women, 19th century women like Colette, early 20th century, or George Sand, for them to wear pants, they had to go get a note from the prefect, from the police, in order to be authorized. But it seems that women they flaunted those rules starting in the late 1860s when they started writing velocipedes, and in 1892 that rule was amended to allow women riding bicycles to dress, to not wear a dress, but to wear pants. And you see the fashion in these engravings and the contrast between the women on the Velocipede and the women who were on the side of the road watching almost longingly, you know, seeing these women in free flowing and clothes that can move in right past.
I mean, gender is an enormous theme of this manual. And honestly, I mean, I have to admit, I was a bit surprised that even at such an early date, we see, I mean, not equal attention, but almost equal attention, and sometimes more attention paid to women as to men. So I wonder if you can pull apart some of the ways in which gender is being commented on or illuminated by this manual.
Yeah. First of all, this 1869 is when a lot of the feminist movements in France really get off the ground. Maria Diram, André Agnew, they publish a text called Le Droit des Femmes, a journal. And so you see the first feminist movements, proto-feminist movements, right? But the first idea of women organizing and pushing for rights, for education for girls, that's happening right as the manual, the Loi Sapir, is being written and published. And so the Loi Sapir seems presented, there are of course plenty of sexist passages in here, right? When you look, there's a chapter in the manual, the Loi Sapir, on fashion. And for men, it's a 3 sentences long, something like that. For women, it's 2 pages long. And here's how they should dress and must dress and so on. So that kind of continues today, right? Men telling women how they should dress. But women are given mobility through the Loi Sapir. People have argued that the bicycle later in the late 19th, early 20th century gives women a measure of freedom that they had never enjoyed before. And I've even read that the Loi Sapir and later the bicycle meant that gene pools changed quite a bit, because suddenly women and men could ride from their small village to the neighboring village to meet partners. And that actually, you know, comes up in the operetta, and it comes up over and over again in the manual of the Loi Sapir, that the Loi Sapir is tied in with romantic relationships. But to go back to the point, women are given mobility. There's this idea that women of different social classes can now have access to freedom of movement. They don't need to rely on men or an expensive horse and carriage to get around. Women, one of the illustrations that we include in here is by the illustrator Albert Roubida, maybe one of the most important of the second half of the 19th century. And he wrote he illustrated a caricature called it's the Saison des Enlèvements, the Season of Abductions. And there's this reference to David's painting, The Abduction of the Sabine Women. But here you have men riding velocipedes carrying women off, but also women riding velocipedes carrying men off. So the velocipede seems to level the playing field a little bit, at least in theory. And so that was a lot of fun to discover and to analyze in our book.
One of the main themes that you all identify, and I think a fairly original contribution as well, is the theme of the carnivalesque. And I didn't, you know, the modernity or anti-modernity and some of the gender politics things that you see in some other places, but this idea of the bicycle as being part of the carnival was really enlightening for me. I was quite taken with it as an idea. So I wonder if you can talk a bit about that.
Yeah, it does seem that, it's clearly a reference for early promoters of the Loi Sapir. There's an advertisement by the Michaud Company from 1869, where they depict a velocipede and tie it in with these carnival figures and the parades that were around carnival. So there is this idea in social class, right, that the bottom and the top are flattened, or that and the velocipede came to be associated with what in France, and this is something I wasn't super aware of until some research I've just done in the last few years, but that there was a mid-Lent sort of a a second carnival event halfway through Lent. It's like the French are saying, we can't make it all the way through. So, and they called that festival the Festival of the Washerwomen, La Fête des Blanchisseuses. And it looks like it was bigger for a number of years, even bigger than Carnival. And the velocipede and music and women being put in a position of queen and the women who were from like the lowest class of working women in Paris were, for a day made into something way above their station. So, and the bicycle fits into that. The Manual of the Velocipede is published by a newspaper that also covered mid-Lent extensively. So those were all tied together around this time. And maybe I'd just read a short paragraph about Carnival. So in Carnival, there's this sort of freedom from the conventional order. The stories are filled, we see this here, the stories are filled with double entendres, the linguistic equivalent of the carnivalesque that brings high and low language together in a single word or phrase, continuing by describing and depicting the velocipede as enmeshed with Carnival. L'Esclide and Michaud succeeded in weaving it into the fabric of a popular festival and grafting it into a centuries-old tradition associated with freedom, fun, and fancy. And on that topic of paradoxes, you've mentioned that, and what I find really fascinating about the velocipede is that especially in the Manual of the Velocipede, they try to attach the velocipede to, they say it's really modern, but it's also really old. And in the manual, they talk about the velocipede being nothing more than a reinvention of Fortuna in mythological terms, the fortune and her wheel. They tie it to Pompeii. They say the first velocipede was a child riding a stick. And the author, Le Grand Jacques in the Manuel du Vélocipède, he goes so far, if I could read this passage from it, quite seriously, the first child riding a stick, this is a chapter on the history of the velocipede, the first child riding a stick like a horse is a primitive inventor of the velocipede. Everything else is just improvement after improvement. It is even possible that the child in question was Abel and his brother Cain, which places the origin of this machine at the creation of the world. So I just find that.
I love that.
Yeah.
100% convinced right away. I was like, of course. Sometimes you read something, it just has like the... It just has the, it's just self-evidently the case.
That's right, yeah. So anyway, it's so kind of outrageous, but it makes sense in this carnivalesque world of the velocipede and the various paradoxes here. So you have this modern, this symbol of modernity tied back to Adam and Eve. It's a symbol of society's elite. It's still expensive, but it offers hope of upward mobility. There's a poor woman who is selling flowers who gets the bug and decides she's going to have a vocation and get into racing velocipedes. This is a woman, right? So there's this hope of upward mobility. There's objectification of women that happens, but also liberation that happens thanks to the velocipede. There's this, it's an industrially produced machine that offers freedom from the industrial world. And these contradictions, I think you mentioned this already, but they do mirror the contradictions of 1860s France in many ways.
Yeah, no, I we could keep talking about some of this even more, but I don't want to take up all of your time because now you're mentioning this, I'm thinking of the small chapter in the manual where the men are watching the women race, and they're talking about the different kinds of races, and you have almost different stock characters of men and different stock characters of women they're watching race. And I was taken by the idea of slow racing. I wanted to learn more about slow racing right away.
Yeah, I have a confession to make. When I was young, I was my parents put me in Boy Scouts, and I had to get the cycling merit badge. And to do that, we had a slow race. And I was, again, just like my other race I described earlier, I was going to win this thing. I was way behind. And then I crashed my bike, so I was out. I was going too slowly. Then I fell over. So once again, near greatness. It's a story of my life.
This is a Second Empire story in some ways, but we know that maybe you would argue that the velocipede is the progenitor of the bicycle. So what happens to velocipedes? Where do they go? When does the mania end? Tell us a little bit about what happens at the end of the story.
Yeah, there are a lot of velocipede clubs. The Second Empire started allowing associations. And you could make the argument that the velocipede paves the way in some respects for the Third Republic, that the social practices that the velocipede entails, the kind of promise of equality, helps train people for Republican practice. But, 1870 happens, and Kobayashi, who wrote a history of the velocipede and the bicycle, talks about the fact that the companies making the velocipede were already in financial trouble by the middle of 1870. But then at the end of 1870, there's the Franco-Prussian War, early 1871, the Paris Commune. And in the conclusion of the book, we talk about various reactions to the velocipede during that. People wrote about it. And the velocipede, because it was associated with freedom and with the carnival, seemed to clash with the seriousness of the Franco-Prussian War and the siege. So the velocipede does fall out of favor. And where in England you have the high wheeler that develops, it's not as big in France. And we have to wait until really the late 1880s until the bicycle kind of resurrects that same kind of energy and enthusiasm in France. And then, of course, that will lead right into the Tour de France and to a huge bicycle culture in France in the first half of the 20th century.
Yeah. I was totally, when I was reading it myself, I was trying to decide for myself, how much is this a precursor? How much is this not a precursor? But I was taken by the idea. I look so much at associational life, but in the 1930s and 40s. And the promise and premises of associational life in under occupation and how important the bicycle becomes in occupied France. And the idea that during the Franco-Prussian War and the siege, it becomes that transcendent nature is the thing that people hold on to, bicycling during the siege is unbelievable because how could you be having fun? But during the occupation of France, bicycling becomes, an essential part of everyday life. There's no gasoline, so you have to bicycle to head up to the countryside to get food, or there's still fun with it, but people aren't riding I can't believe people are riding their bicycles for fun. People are like, oh, we need more bicycles.
Right. And you see this tension, between the note on the velocipede, this kind of utilitarian thing, and then the freedom and fun of it way back at, in the 1860s, 1868, 1869. And there is that same tension, I think. You have people that say, well, I bike because it's utilitarian, it gets me to work. And then others that ride, like I do, I love getting in the mountains. I don't race, but I still ride for pleasure and for exercise and for, socializing with other cyclists. That kind of tension runs through to today.
Well, it's a bit of an auspicious day for actually to do the interview, and I didn't really think about it too much, but we have a union at our university, and we just got a note today that our union wants to fight for, I forget the term they were using in the email, but basically facilities for after transit. Like if you ride your bicycle to work, do you have anywhere to clean up, you know, or you do have to teach, you know, in your sweaty, you know, joggers and things like that. So that's one of the things they'd like to fight for in the near future, that so that you can bicycle or scooter was also in lots of, I think you've gone out on your way to work.
Yeah, and I've seen I was at the University of Arizona recently, and I was with a colleague, and she reached out and grabbed me at one point, and I stopped, and a cyclist went right in front of us, and she said, they have right of way on campus, and they also have a valet service for bicycles in some universities. We have a ways to go here at my university to get there, but
it strikes me that a university is the perfect place for some of this, especially if you have lots of students on campus. But look, this has really been a pleasure, Corey. I'll ask you the question I ask everybody at the end, which is, you know, what do we have to look forward to next? What's kind of next on the horizon? And if it's not a sports history thing, that's okay too, because a lot of people have more than one interest or field.
Actually, I am working on a colleague of mine named Maxence Lecomte. He's at Trinity University in Texas. Sure, he's putting together, you know, Maxence, he's putting together a book on sport in Paris. He's trying to get it out before the Olympics next summer.
I'm the slowest person in that race.
Oh, are you? Okay, good. I'm glad to hear you're in the race, though. That's good to hear.
Yeah, I'm very slow. Sorry, Max.
I've been working with my colleague Pratima Prasad at the University of Massachusetts in Boston on a chapter about Eugène Chaput, who was Guadeloupean born, and he wrote a book called Le Sport à Paris, Sport in Paris, and that same year, 1854, started the first newspaper in France devoted to sports. And our argument, though, is that when he says sport, he doesn't mean the same thing that we mean when we say sport. So for him, it's about integrating and belonging to the Jean du Monde. That's the subtitle of his newspaper, to sort of the Parisian high life. So the newspaper covers hunting and horse racing, but also theater, cafes, masked balls, chess. And so that's the argument. That's been kind of fun to dig into.
Yeah, he's talking about baseball, you know.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, like he borrows that and then kind of tries to define it in a way that makes sense for people trying to integrate this upper class world in Paris.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I'm already looking forward to reading it. That sounds fantastic.
Well, and I'm looking forward to reading what you even if it's a little slow. I'm happy that you're on that project.
I'm just writing about Australians and New Zealanders, Antipodean sportsmen who come over to Paris and the role they play in shaping French thinking about different kinds of rugby. But it's just a sideline for me in some ways, because during the COVID era, it was hard to get over to France to do any research. So had to look at more local sources.
Well, maybe that will help me get over my depression of France losing in the World Cup, the Rugby World Cup.
We don't want to
start down that road, Keith.
The Australians also didn't do so well.
I know. Yeah, unfortunately.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Corey. And thank you everyone for listening. I've been speaking with Corey Cropper. He's a professor of French at Brigham Young University, and he's one of the two authors of a book that's just fantastic. And frankly, from my point of view, useful for scholars doing their own research, but also would be really great to bring into classrooms. The book is Velocipedomania, A Cultural History of the Velocipede in France. It's out this year with Bucknell University Press. So I should mention the other author, of course, Seth Whedon, who couldn't join us today. He's a professor of French literature and a fellow at Queen's College, Oxford. But thank you, Corey, very much for joining us. And it's really been a pleasure to have you here today.
Keith, it was a blast. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you all for listening.